The only things that were working were trucks that we allowed to run. Ice wagons that were under contract, the milk wagons that were under contract. And whatever else, ambulances and things like that. Otherwise, we stopped everything in the city. And on Saturday morning, the employers decided to move out some produce. And strange thing in this city, the market district, right almost in the center of town. Now you're familiar with downtown Seattle. So we'll pick a corner like, let's say 3rd and Pike. Well, we'll go over now to 3rd and about Union. That'd be one block from the first avenue. The market district would begin, just the way that it was there. Two blocks from the main street. And it was a compact unit where all the commission brokers had their shops. They had big fruit options on the railroad tracks, too. They had their shops, their stores, their warehouses. About 20, 25 firms in there in about a three-block area. They were concentrated. And I guess the employers figured that was the place to go. Because in a truck strike, it's a little bit different than a factory. A factory you can't move. But a truck strike, it's mobile. And you can be any place. And it's a more difficult strike to conduct. And it's more difficult also to police. And it's more difficult to fight because it's spread out so much. Well, you can't concentrate pickets at one place because you need so many. Well, Saturday morning they decided that they would move some trucks. And they backed into a produce company. Well, when we got down there, they moved them in under police escort. And they were all harness boys. That's the term. They were all cops in uniform. There were no thugs. The book says thugs, but they weren't there. They were all harness boys. They were in uniform.
Harness boys?
Huh? Harness boys. That's cops in uniform. That's a street expression for cops in uniform. Harness. H-A-R-N-E-S-S. Bull. B-U-L-L-S. Cops in uniform, they call them harness men. Well, they started working on us. We were all barehanded. They injured quite a few of us. Arrested quite a few. And they give us a beat. No question about it. And
when you say gave us a beating, how badly?
Huh?
When you say gave us a beating, how badly was
it? Oh, I got 22 stitches in the head. I was not the worst beat up either. They arrested a lot of guys. Two or three went to the jailhouse. And, but we went and we made our mind up. We were gonna fight. It was just a question. We were young and we, you know, if you made your mind up, you're gonna go for broke or work the rest of your life in slavery. I'd worked 8 years.
What was the average age of the men who were striking?
Oh, now that's a hard thing to say, but I know the guys in the leadership of the union, with the exception of Ray Dunn and Carl Scoglin and Ray Rainbow, none of them was over 27, 28 years old. And between 20 and 28 years, no, I was about the youngest, I was 22, between 22 and 30 years old. That was the guys that were, now there were a lot of people that were older.
Right, but just
but the group that were going for broke, they were all young men. And my dad had been blacklisted in the 1917 strike and a lot of other guys. And there were some older men, but the average, the guys that were in the more or less active leadership were young men, below 30. And most of them around 25, 26. And we said, we're going to go. Well, over the weekend, we got ready. And Monday morning, the company that's out here, that's now owned by Stevedore Company, Pacific Fruit and Produce, back there was Gamble Robbins. They were going to run that morning. And we decided they weren't going to run. And boy, we had a Donnybrook there. And 33 policemen went to the hospital that morning. Now, we had a lot of people injured. But nobody got arrested. We had guys with broken arms, a couple of them. Guys with bad heads. And you see, the cops couldn't shoot, we knew it, because it was too close quarters. And we give them an awful shellacking. So we felt pretty cocky. Well, the next day, that night, the newspapers went into high gear.
But how many men would be at any one of these rallies or...
That place?
Yeah.
Probably 8,000 or 10,000. They weren't all strikers.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, I forgot to tell you that. Carl Skoglund told us, he was a great old guy. He said, now brothers, and he had a sweet accent. He said, the unemployed, we got to cultivate them. We got to explain to them that this is their job too. But he said, if we don't take them in and make them part of this fight, they realize that if they get a job, they're going to have a job with good conditions. And they don't want a job with bum conditions. And we organized the unemployed. Well, but we didn't really take credit for that because, as I told you earlier, the unemployed had organized themselves. And we just kind of annexed them. But these guys, there were a lot of them that were trade union people that had been laid off. But Minneapolis was not a well-organized town. It was an open shop city.
Mm-hmm.
They broke strikes there. It was run by an employer's organization. And we had the unemployed on our side. And we had about 7,000 people in the union. And that don't mean that they were all there.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a lot of sympathetic people in the union that were with us. Building trades and other craftsmen. A lot of guys come off the job. And they come down there because it was the chance to get even over all these years. And everybody realized that if we lost that beef, it'd be tougher for them. So the next day, that night, they swore in 1,500 special deputies. And the next morning, they marched down again in the market. By now, there's 20, 30,000 people there. They're not all strikers, they're not all pickets. They're people coming down to see what happens. Oh, you couldn't walk. Well, they brought in these special deputies, and I don't know what happened. All of a sudden, the fireworks begins. And before it's over, two of the special deputies were killed. Again, nobody went to jail. Nobody got pinched. But the cops wouldn't mix into it. On that Tuesday morning, the cops couldn't get into it.
So
they got so badly beat up on Monday, they wouldn't get into it on Tuesday.
Okay, so on Monday, how many police officers were there against the 8,000 to 10,000 strikers?
Oh, they had all the police force they could get. They probably had everybody they could get. They had at least 600-700.
And then the next day, none of them would come back. So
they were there.
But they wouldn't
mix in because,
okay.
See, a lot of cops didn't go to the hospital. A lot of them didn't go to the hospital because they got whacked around.
Mm-hmm.
And then they didn't. They saw their buddies getting it. And after all, the cop's just a guy working for wages too. He didn't want to get hurt if he could get away from it. But the next morning, on Tuesday morning, then we have no way of knowing, but there was a story out that in addition to the two guys getting killed, 400 special deputies were treated at hospitals. Now, we don't have any figure on that, and I wouldn't speak to that. Mm-hmm. But they do, and I do know that two were killed because they had two dead bodies. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to admit that. Well, then we had a truce. There'd be no more attempt to move any trucks. And by Saturday morning, we had an agreement. Now, we got betrayed by the governor.
Yeah, let me back up. When they were moving these trucks, were they their own trucks and then the employers were going to drive them?
No.
Or what was happening?
Well, we don't know who they had driving.
Okay, so they had been brought in.
They had brought somebody to drive. They didn't load any cargo. Mm-hmm. When Gamble Rob came in, that's Pacific Fruit and Produce, they brought three trucks into their warehouse. And they were going to haul, it was a test case.
Okay.
And they never got them back to the platform to load them. And they were using supervisory personnel to run the warehouse. Mm-hmm. They got, you know, they got all their office people, see, that ain't involved in this, right? And they got a job, and they're human beings, and they say, hey, you come down here and go to work. Well, the guy ain't belong to the union, where's he going? He's got a wife and a family, and he's a human being, and he reacts. He comes down and goes to work. Well, they didn't do anything. Well, here come the key stumbling blocks. I went into detail to tell you about the women, the inside worker, which was a great share of the women. Mm-hmm. And a great share of the industrial idea of the union. Now, Dan Tobin, the head of the international union, the head of the drivers, he didn't go too much for this international union.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't believe in that. He lambasted the hell out of us later on. But the employers, they didn't want to give in to this inside worker stuff. They would have been willing, maybe, to give a contract for the driver and maybe the helper.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to give a contract that would provide for the elevator operator, the guy making up the loads in the warehouse. Anything, if any guy was on that payroll working for that company was going to come under our agreement. That was the way we had our mind made up. And, of course, they did not want to bring in there the equality of women. No, I'm a bug on that.
Those 20,000 who'd go out there, were some of those women?
Huh?
Were some of those women who would go out, like the
20,000
that were facing?
Yeah, there were women, yeah. They had, see, in all the big department stores, they had big belts. Packages would be purchased and they'd come down the belts. Well, they had women booking, stubbers booking.
Mm-hmm.
And we had women, they were working, and we said, what the hell? If they ain't got women, they'd have men.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd be paying the men 50 cents an hour, why don't the woman, she doing the same job, why ain't she entitled to 4 bits an hour? Well, that's what they didn't want. Well, we were just as goddamn well determined they were going to do it, and we forced them to. Well, the contract that we got, now you want to remember this is 1934, and it took a lot of doing to get a contract with the employer. And the employer didn't sit down in the room with us and meet us across the table. Our committee was in one room in a hotel, and the employer was in another room down the hall in the hotel. And in this case, the governor of the state of Minnesota was acting as a mediator or whatever, conciliator. And he was carrying back, you know, he'd say, well, the employer don't want to go for that. We'd tell him one thing. Now, I was not in those negotiations when I say we.
At the time, who was the governor?
Huh?
Who was the governor?
Floyd Olson. He was the farm labor governor. I knew him well. I knew his dad, too.
Is it O-L-S-O-N?
Yeah, it's all in the book. Okay. You'll see it. It's all there. Olson. Mm-hmm. He could speak Jewish better, as good as he could speak English. He was multilingual. He was raised in a Jewish section. He spoke Yiddish as good as he spoke English, and he spoke Swede and Norwegian. He was a talented guy. And his father was a checker, freight checker at the NP Railroad. Mm-hmm. And if you had a pint of moonshine in your pocket to give old Mike a drink, you better get yours first. He was just a husky drinker. He wasn't chiseling. He'd just take a big drink. And
so how did the governor betray?
Well, he told the employers one thing, obviously. And he come back and says, yes, fellas, the employers agreed that the inside people will be covered. That's on section, it was in section 8, I think. Well, he assured us that our understanding that the inside workers and something else would be the way we wanted it. See, there was no direct negotiations. So we went back to work. We got an agreement on wages. It was typical of the time, what they call those labor board agreements. They had labor boards set up in the communities. And you didn't deal directly with the employer, you dealt through a labor board. And so we accepted that it worked. And we went back to work thinking that, well, when you get back, you get started going to work after about 2 weeks, and you start working the bugs out of the thing. Pretty soon, we found out that it wasn't just the way that Floyd told us it was. Well, they said, oh, no, we didn't agree to that. Well, we'd get a hold of Olson, try to work it out. He was pretty clever. He was an attorney. He was a damn clever one. Well, finally, on July 16th, we had a strike again. And by now, the employers were really ready to take us on. And about the third day of the strike, they set up a trap. We didn't buy that. The next day, they come down to move us.
What trap did they set up?
Well, they sent a truck in to pick up some stuff in a warehouse. Mm-hmm. Supposed to go to a hospital supplies. And we were supposed to try to stop it so they'd get up a lot of propaganda in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. Well, the boys on that particular deal didn't buy it. So we didn't get trapped into that. A day or so later, they put a truck into Slocum Burger. And they loaded about a sack of oatmeal and a case of cornflakes and something else on it. And started out. We had a pickup truck down there, and we had, oh, at least 5,000 union pickets, and there had to be 10,000 other people there, and the cops just started shooting, and they shot 67 of us and killed two right there. And Olson was already, they put the city in martial law. We lived with that for over a month. And we finally won. It was a hell of a struggle.
Now, when those, what exactly happened with when you went and picketed and those men were shot? What was the employer doing?
Well, We have the town tied up tight again. And Olson, immediately when we went out on strike, he assembled the National Guard on the grounds that he wanted. The captain of police, Bloody Mike Johannes, said that he couldn't maintain order. And Olson then assembled 4,000 National Guardsmen in the armory, because they don't take the guardsmen from here, you know, for this city. They get them from outside. That's the national trace as well.
The chief of police was called Bloody Mike Hansen.
Yeah, Bloody Mike Johannes. And this Olson, he was an able guy. If you read that book, you'll see. I was working for the employer chairman, Joe Cochran. He was the employer's chairman. And Olson was clever. Oh, he was clever. But he had the guard assembled. So on Friday, they brought this truck into Slocumburg. There was a warehouse, a grocery warehouse. And they backed it into the, they had the windows all covered up with chicken wire and everything, so the driver couldn't get hurt with bricks or anything. And we were down there. See, we had developed a form of the cruising picket squad, because you just can't picket a truck terminal. You know, the trucks move around. So we developed a cruising picket squad of 25, 35 cars, 3, 4, 5 men in a car. And we cruise around town, and we didn't have shortwave radios, but we had motorcycles and telephone, and we check in. We had checkpoints. We had all sorts of people down, and they brought the firemen down to try to break us up. But the firemen came down and they said, no, we fight fire, we don't fight strike. And they took their fire trucks away. They tried to break us up with water. And about an hour later, they brought in the rest of the police force, probably 200 policemen.
Did the firemen actually turn the water on you?
They wouldn't do it. The battalion chief came down, and Harry DeBoer and myself were there in charge of pickets. Harry was number one. Wyatt had a big squad there and a few more. And when they came down, he said, what's the trouble here? And Harry told him. And he told the guys, get back on the truck, fellas. He said, we fight fire, we don't fight pickets. And they left. Well, in about an hour, down come about another, at least 40 cars of cops. They all got out of their cars, and they all had them riot guns. They had this truck backed up to the platform. And they put, well, what looked to me like a couple of sacks of oatmeal and a case of cornflakes and something else in it. They started out with it. And there was, we had a truck, we had more than one, but there was a truckload of pickets there was going to head it off. And the cops shot right in, and they shot 67 people. And the outside, Harry DeBoer, myself, and Ben Costin, we're the only three got it fatal. The other three got it, all the others got it in the back. And we got it, we come around the corner. We ran into a guy with a machine gun, he let go. Harry was in the hospital for 5 months. And they shot 4 inches out of his leg, and they had a graft of bone in there. And Kosky just about got his hand severed. I got lucky, I just got the spare part. My ribs cracked and all lacerated the hell out of me. I bleed, but wasn't. I thought I was dead, but it was just, you know, surface wounds. But all the other guys, two guys were killed. Henry Ness and John DeLore.
Henry Ness?
Yeah, it's all in the book, all the names and everything. So.
So you had set up another truck to.
Huh?
You had set up a truck to cut off.
Oh, we had pickets and trucks, everything else.
To cut off this one truck that was carrying.
Yeah, oh, sure, that was the aim. We didn't believe in backing away. So, see, at the beginning of the strike, they'd sent in a couple of negotiators, Father Hoss, Catholic priest, a guy by the name of Dunnigan. The idea was to work out an agreement. Well, we didn't like the agreement. Old Skogie said, employers ain't going to take it, so we'll take it. We outfoxed it. We agreed to it. Well, the employers didn't. They said, we can't deal with the Reds. Well, I tell you, 98% of the union didn't know the difference between communism and rheumatism. You know, they didn't know the difference. And but we had a democratically run thing.
What do you mean by democratically run?
The men ran it. We had a strike committee of 100. Now, we didn't have 100 men every day because guys worked night and day, you know, and were gone. But every morning or every crisis, if there was any need, we'd call the strike committee together. We'd have 50, 60 men, sometimes 100, like at night when we had the big mass meetings. And we used to get 30, 40,000 people in the meetings because the whole city had turned out. Mm-hmm. And we'd have a strike committee meeting. Everything was done right there, right out in front of God and everybody. There was no leaders running the strike there. The men in the ranks run it. It was democratic as hell. Mm-hmm. And that's what made it so hard, you see. Because the papers would say that the commies are running the union. Well, when Pete Bovey'd get up and make a motion, the next day they'd have it in the paper that commies was running it. Everybody says, geez, that Pete Bovey, he'd knock you down if you called him a commie, and he's the guy that made the motion.
Mm-hmm.
They saw through it all.
How did the papers react? How did they?
Oh, boy, they were awful.
What were they writing up?
Oh, it was all, everything was communism. They were agents of Moscow, and they had their records and all of this, you know. And I threw some stuff in here. I'm working under, kind of, I haven't been well. I threw a whole bunch of stuff in. And then they tried to steal the damn truck from us.
What did you say?
They tried to steal the strike after we agreed to it. Then they tried to take it away from us in the voting. They tried to. I thought I had some pictures here. I was in such a hurry today. I got calls this morning. A very, very good friend of mine that I work with in the union. His wife was taken to the hospital in Oxnard. They're going to operate on her lung for cancer, and it was kind of upset my schedule today. And my oldest sister down in San Diego had to go to the hospital. She's got a respiratory problem. This flu was just knocking the hell out of everybody. I thought I had some pictures that I just grabbed up.
When you say they tried to take the, try to steal the strike after the
see, when we settled the strike, mm-hmm. It was to be done by an election. And the employers tried to put in ringers. We challenged them. Well, then they tried to bring in lawyers and tried to take it away from us that way. And
ringers?
Well, people that weren't there. That's an expression. You put a ringer in instead of a genuine person.
Oh.
All right. Damn it. Thank you. gun, I guess I didn't, I had some pictures of his truck and the whole schmear. Well, I can leave them for John at the hall. But I could have explained him so much easier. But I don't know if I've been helpful to you.
Oh, you are amazing. How, did the newspapers try to break the strike in any way?
Oh, certainly they did.
And how?
Oh, by telling us that we were all imported people, that we were Reds, that they had the troops on there, you know, and they arrested everybody. They couldn't throw them in a stockade. They had a military police, martial law for about 4 weeks or 5 weeks, and they tried to, at every instance where there was a question.
Were there any newspapers or editors sympathize with you? Were there any newspapers?
Oh, none. We had our own newspaper. We started our own paper called The Organizer, and we put that out every day. And then Tobin, the head of the International Union, there was no bones made about it. Carl Skoglund and Ray Dunn. But they were revolutionary socialists. They never made any bones that they weren't. And they played that up and put it in the newspaper, and they made all sorts of chatter about it.
What were the different ways that the employers tried to break the strikes?
Well, they were trying to, at every instance, they were trying to get the men to go back to work. And they did, see, with the military permits. Oh, here it is. You can have this. That was in the second strike. This is the truck. This is the truck. You can see there's nothing in the truck.
Mm-hmm.
Now this was a load of pickets. And they were going to run the truck down. There is no one.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I had some more, and you could see the cops up there. If I can put my hands on them, I'll leave them at the hall for John.
Okay.
We'll see the cops shooting. Mm-hmm. This is in the first strike. This guy owned a business, $100,000 business at the time, and he come down there to be a special deputy, and he got killed right there. That's all that happened. He just knocked in the head. That was the end of him, and another guy got killed the same day.
What made the police all of a sudden, you said that in the beginning, you know, or when they were down there, that they didn't fire, and you knew that they wouldn't fire on you. What made them change to where, at a later point, that they would open up?
Well, the reason we knew they couldn't fire me.
Mm-hmm.
There were too many mixes. But here, in this picture, they had established people along here.
Yeah. Okay.
There was nobody in here.
Mm-hmm.
There was nobody. See, when we were milling around down in the market district, when we were down in Gamble Rob, they were so close, they couldn't fire because they'd have shot themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That was the only reason, I believe. I'll leave these books with you, and you can read them at your leisure. I'll be gone for 10 days.
What type of weapons did the strikers use?
Oh, none. We had the big problem.
Mm-hmm.
We had to take the weapons away from them after the shooting. We had to search their cars, because we couldn't, you can't outshoot. And if we'd had one car out on the street, well, we had sticks, chains, and stuff down our pockets, but we never had any guns or anything.
Did you use rocks or bricks?
Oh, yeah, if you had a chance, certainly, but never no weapons. No weapons whatsoever.
Okay.
You can't win if you don't have nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, here in this instance, see, here's where the cops are laying. Now, these pictures, when you read this book, you'll see it. The pickets were all milling around. It was a different situation. The cops were laying all over the street that morning. Mm-hmm. And this was after we'd given to them. Mm-hmm. They beat the hell out of us on Saturday. But that morning, what we had that day, I got to be honest with you, we had pipes up our sleeves, mm-hmm. down our pants legs. We had chains. And when the cops turned two on us, we just turned right around and give it back.
Do you think that that beating on Saturday really evoked the men?
Yes.
To do it?
They sure
do you think
did.
That they would have been that strong and that determined?
No, they wouldn't have been that determined. I know it was with me. Hell, they're out to kill you. They tried it on me more than once. I had my mind made up. They weren't going to do it.
Few more of the ways that the employers tried to break the strike.
Well, I started to tell you and I got away from it. The way they tried to break, they used Olson. The union agreed and the Hawes-Dunnigan agreed. We accepted it. The employer,
it's called a joke.
The Hawes-Dunnigan agreement. That's what the two mediators, Father Hawes and Dunnigan. They made a proposal. Now, it wasn't what the union wanted. Skoglund says it ain't what we want, but we can live with it because it's going to recognize the inside workers, it's going to recognize the union, and it's going to allow us to continue. April 17, this is a discussion between Cynthia Sherwood and myself concerning the Minneapolis strike of 1934. Is because it done two things. It turned the Teamsters Union from a craft union to an industrial union. And secondly, the people who were instrumental had a different position on feminism. Mm-hmm. They were feminists, which were hard to find in the middle 30s, early 30s. Carl Skoglund was an old Swede, he was a Swedish immigrant. And Ray Dunn, who was an American born person, were originally Debs and Socialists. And they had gone through the period of Eugene Debs' activity in the Socialist Party of America. And they had then developed into the left wing of the Socialist Party. And when the right wing group of the American Socialist Party started to get involved in the rat race for war and all of that theory, World War I, they disbanded the Socialist Party, and those who were in the left followed Debs and were to the left of Debs, organized the left wing, and out of that come the American Communist Party, which was not connected to, but followed in pattern. Communist Party in the Soviet, what later became the Soviet Union. Subsequently, there were problems of direction, problems of leadership, problems or ideas, which way to go. And when Lenin was wounded in 1922, and we eventually succumbed in 1924, the party secretariat was headed then by Joseph Stalin. There was a sharp outbreak of people who were for those who were against Stalin. There were no evidences of that in America at the time. But in about 5 years, there were people in America who were in the Communist Party, I never was, who were having problems with Stalin. And they organized what was called the Left Opposition to Stalin. And later on, they became followers of Leon Trotsky. Now it's well that one understands that. Now there were two, just two, at that time who were the ringleaders, you might say, of this issue in Minneapolis. And they were splendid people. They were far-sighted individuals. And they had been through labor struggles before. Carl was a very, very able mechanic and worked for the Pullman Company. And he was a mechanic. You see, Pullman leased the sleeping cars to the railroads. The railroads never owned the sleeping cars. They leased them from Pullman, so they had various people. And during the shopman's strike of 1921-22, they lost it. There was a wave of strikes that were defeated in that period, including the longshore, including the seamen, and many other crafts, the shopmen and the railroad. So the labor movement, including the West Coast, the East Coast longshoremen, were driven almost to oblivion. And there were very little semblances of union. Following that,
why can't I?
Go ahead. Anytime you want to stop and ask questions.
Why was it in 1922 or during that time that you had the strikes? Why were they defeated then? And then
well,
later on?
You see, it follows that after a period of time, when there are wars, there seems to be a period of reaction sets in. And there was mass unemployment after World War I. There was not so much mass unemployment in the War of 1898 because America had not become an imperialist nation. That's when they first became, but they hadn't developed yet. Mm-hmm. So the reaction of all the people coming back from war, the economy which was geared to making ships, geared to war economy, suddenly there was no more work. People were become out of work, and therefore there was a lack of any interest for them to find work in the private sector. And a sort of, a depressed economic state became. Well, they weren't quite satisfied with just breaking the strikes. There became a wave of hysteria. And of course, the Russian workers had succeeded in overthrowing the Tsar. And the Western nations, or the Allies, they felt now that they were going to be able to dump the Russian workers and return the Russian country to the descendants of the Tsar, people in his name. There were two revolutions in 1917. But the workers headed them off, and as a result of that, they managed to make their society a durable one. And this panic over the Western society. And to this day, I don't have to tell you, we don't have a compatible interest with Soviet Union or for a while a Chinese or any of the societies or that are claimed to be or wish they were non-capitalist. So there's always a struggle going on. And they started political raids then called the Palmer Raids. And they chased out everybody from the labor movement that they could. And then Samuel Gompers, he chased out some more. Now all of this, I'm telling you, because the background that preceded why the American worker did what they did in 34, and I'm just running over the top of it. Mm-hmm. They destroyed the labor movement, similarly to what had been done here in this country through 8 years of Reaganism. Mm-hmm. Now, whether one's for Reagan or not, we have to admit that the country is in a disastrous state, unemployment, high costs of everything, and a tremendous amount of people out of work, and all sorts of problems that face people. 37 million people with no hospitalization, homeless people, and I don't mean bums, I mean entire families. I tell you, it tears my heart up. I drive down the city at night and see women with children sleeping in doorways. Now, these are not bums. They're not hardcore bums. They're not hobos. They're people that can't make it. And all over the country, they're reporting this. And this was quite as bad. But the soup kitchens of the Depression, the out-of-work people, all of this brought about a state of unrest and determination. And what was most appalling was the loss of dignity of people that had no money, that were living from hand to mouth, were being evicted from their homes. And that's what brought about a series of strikes in 1934. And the first one started was a small one in Minneapolis. But to go back a little bit more into history, Carl Skogman and Ray Dunn.
Can you spell Carl Skogman's
name? Skogman is spelled S-K-O-G-L-U-N-D. And Ray Dunn is D-U-N-N-E. Now he was a family of brothers, about six of them. And they were all left of center people. But what made them outstanding was that they were people that had a political belief. And it was a belief that was not based upon getting favors from the political person. Governors in the state apparatus. In the state of Minnesota, they had what they call the Farm Labor Party. It was more the Democratic Party in my day there, the time I was born in 1911 until the time I left. The Democratic Party was not the party. It was either the Farm Labor Party or the Republican. And they were not really a revolutionary party. They were just going to reform. They wanted to get a better break for the farmer and a better break for the worker within the framework of the existing society. They didn't want to revolutionize it and make it strictly a workers' and farmers' government, so no one should believe it. And they had some vicious struggles in the city prior to that. But all over the country there was unrest. And Ray and Carl and probably 10 or 15 other people who had been members of the Communist Party and were expelled because of their opposition to belief made them a different type of person. than the average person that conducted affairs in unions. Now, I don't want to do a lot of soapboxing, but I want to give you a little... These were unusual people. Now, I had been associated with the IWW, that was the Industrial Workers of the World. And they were a radical group of people who were organized in 1905. And they were more direct action type people. And they were real activists. But they had been beset upon by the government. And their era was on the wane. They were great out here in the West. They were great in the construction industry in the Midwest. They had some influence on the ships. And they had a bearing in the politics of the unions in which they participated. But the other unions, the old trade unions, the AFL craft unions, which were very, well, reactionary. And they were real, they were not the type of people that wanted to go out, be startling with anything. They didn't want to bring on any kind of problem. They wanted to go and make some kind of a deal with the employer, or they got a little bit for some and not so much for the other, and maybe nothing for a whole lot of other people. And they particularly wanted to deal with only the craft unions. And they didn't want to deal too much with the unorganized people. So it was quite an idea when Scoglin and Dunn had their ideas about coming into the Teamsters. Now, the Teamsters Union was mostly what was generally referred to as cash wagon. It's hard for people to realize today what the way of life was 60 years ago, 50 years ago. Today, the homemaker or the wife or the woman running the home, she jumps in her car and she paddles away to the supermarket. She goes to the shopping center. She takes the laundry in that has to be dry cleaned. She doesn't have facilities at home to do the laundry. She throws it in the laundromat while she's in shopping. She picks up the meat. She picks up the groceries in the supermarket. She goes to the bakery for specialty breads. Everything is all, you do it yourself. You don't have things delivered because there's a charge, and the delivery service is deliberately made slow so that you're not encouraged to have them deliver. Well, in my day, when I was a little kid, that's over 60 years ago, I'm 77, the grocery man, all of them, had, you never hear of a grocery having your groceries delivered. Well, there were no supermarkets. Everybody didn't have one, two, or three cars in the family. So how would you get your week's groceries or your couple of days' groceries? All the grocery stores of any significant size had either a horse and wagon or a little Model T Ford truck or some other kind, or in some cases just young kids with wagons delivering groceries. And the bigger companies had fleets of trucks delivering groceries. So you'd go into the store and you'd order what you wanted, and they'd make it up. They had big boxes that were collapsible, and they'd fill them up. The next day, you'd get your groceries, or the following day. You went down to Frederick and Nelson, and you bought some things, and you're on a shopping tour. You didn't take them and put them in the trunk of your car. You had them delivered. And then you went over to Nordstrom's, and you bought some more things, and they were delivered. And wherever you went, things were delivered. And there was no extra charge. And bakery goods, they used to come, they had a big tray, they'd rap on the door, and they'd bring all sorts of bench goods, they called it, donuts, rolls, Danish pastry, and if you wanted cakes, you'd order them. And they had fresh bread and all different kinds, and it was to the door. Even the coffee and tea and coffee and spices. And the only one that's left today that does that are two. One is Watkins, and they still have people rapping on doors delivering spices. And Fuller Brush, I think they still canvas, but not very much. Everything was done. Your laundry, you used to have big sacks, and you could get what they call wet wash, or you could get finished laundry. If you wanted wet wash, you had a certain sack. They had two kind of sacks. They were colored. If you want a blue wet wash, where my mother dealt, you put them in the blue bag. The stuff you want finished went in the white bag. That'd come back ironed and pressed, and the blue bag would come back wet, and you'd hang it out, and you'd finish it accordingly or not, as you wanted it. So all these drivers worked on a commission basis, and that's where they got the nickname Cash Wagon. And they had some other drivers, but the majority of the drivers in the union were Cash Wagon drivers. And the whole industry changed when they started in with the supermarkets and the chain stores, they called them. And when they had all the services curtailed, there was put any service you want. They come to the door, your coffee, your bread, your laundry, anything. And of course the big stores, like the department stores, they get rid of most of their delivery service and the idea of patriotism. During the war, they said it's not patriotic to have your goods delivered. It takes gas and it takes rubber. So please carry home your packages. The real motive behind it was they were getting rid of a big cost. It cost money to have a big fleet of trucks. So the industry in 1930 in the Teamsters Union was an industry where the majority of the drivers were salesmen, or they worked on a commission basis. They had a little bit of a draw. And then they had an arrangement where they got so many cents over each dollar that they sold. They had a break, like they got $20 a week for up to $300, and if they sold another 100, they got 10% of 100, and it elevated. That was to encourage them to hustle. Well, that's where the name Cash Wagon comes from, most of them. And there was yet no big delivery of motor freight between city and city. There were no highways like we have today, because their highway systems hadn't been developed. And railroads was the method of getting freight from city to city. And when you wanted to move, when I first started in the industry, and you wanted to move from one city that was quite a few miles away, we'd come out a week before, we'd crate your furniture, we'd pack it. put the dishes in barrels, and we'd crate up this furniture and all of that, and we'd haul it down to the team track and put it in boxcars and tie it up. That was the style. Well, Carl and Ray figured that where the bakery drivers were in one, tea and coffee drivers in another, and the ice drivers, and then they used to deliver ice, which is another thing you don't know about today. They didn't have mechanical refrigeration. There were no refrigerators. You had wet ice, and you had a card in the window if you wanted 25 or 50 or 100 pounds. The guy'd walk down the street with his horse wagon, he'd chop off 50 pounds, and he'd come in your kitchen and put it in your ice box, and the water'd melt, and you had a big pan, and you had to run it out, and you didn't, it slopped all over the floor. Well, the union was not an industrial union. It was a craft union. Although they were drivers, you see, they were in various segregated. But Carl and Ray were of the opinion that the only way that the union could succeed and be a threat to the employer in order to bargain effectively, that they would have to be organized into a unit where everybody in the bargaining unit was together. So they couldn't be chipped apart and been broken off into small little units. So that's why the strikes in Minneapolis, the second and third strikes, were important. And of course, that changed the whole pattern of American labor relations, with three strikes in 34. And I've got some paper for you. I'm going to leave with you. You can have. It's just brief. It's concise, but it'll give you a little better background. And now that's the kind of the foreword that brought it. The idea of then, of course, the women. Now, usually, in the beginning of the American labor movement, there were a lot of women in the labor movement. And one of the great massacres of union people was the American Shirtwaist Company, where they locked these women into the plant. They were up sewing. They were sewing on piecework. 117 of them burned to death in the American Shirtwaist Factory in New Jersey. They shut the doors. I don't know why. I suppose to keep them in there and keep them working so they didn't run out or anybody, you know, bother. And the big textile strikes. Women played an important role, but and they were impressed into labor at an early age in the textile mills in the East. And child labor was involved, and women were involved, and there was a lot of women employed in the trucking industry. They were employed not as drivers, but they were employed in clerical jobs. They were employed in non-driving jobs, and they were employed there because they were cheaper. And we took the position that we were going to bargain for them as well as the men. This had never been heard of before. And because of Ray and Carl and their socialist understanding of things, they believed in the old Chinese proverb that women hold up half the sky, and that women are half the working class, and they should be able to enjoy the benefits of their labor for a very selfish reason. If a man is able to get a dollar an hour and a woman can do the work right alongside him, at 50 cents an hour, she's a detriment to his wage scale. It's a selfish thing. Well, I don't know how you look at it, but that's the way it looks. And women are employed and doing the same work, and all these relative scales and everything hadn't been thought of at that time. So we, those of us who were young and who could think for ourselves, we were supportive of the idea of making the Teamsters Union in the city of Minneapolis an industrial union. And we were equally supportive of supporting the women. Now, some of the dirtiest jobs were given to women. Now, we have the big, now that's all gone from here. Well, it's still around. But before the big, first they called them chain stores. Now we call them supermarkets. They've got their own facilities now. Safeway and Lucky and all of them. They've got their own big green rooms. They've got their own potato warehouses, everything. They got their own produce markets. Mm-hmm. Well, 60, 70 and up until, oh, I suppose 25, 30 years ago, up until the beginning, until the end of World War II, there were many, many what they called commission houses. Mm-hmm. I would be able to make contact with a grower, say, in Arizona, mm-hmm. or a broker, and send me up five cars of whatever he was selling. And then I'd haul them from the team track, the railroad station, bring them up, or I'd sell them at an auction right on the railroad track. And in potatoes, onions, rutabagas, and turnips, and things like that that can spoil. And they have problems. After a certain period of time, they have to sort them. Because all of them don't stand time the same way. Some soften up. Well, you've noticed it yourself. Mm-hmm. You're around the kitchen, you go to the store and buy 10 pounds of potatoes, and if you don't get to using them up, some of them start to soften. They spoil, they smell, you can throw them out. Onions, everything. Well, the big warehouse is the same thing. So they have a man on the end of the line, takes a 100-pound sack, he dumps them on a belt. And there's probably 10, 15, depending on how big the plant is. They got women on either side, and as these potatoes, onions, or whatever come rolling down, they sort them out to make sure that there's no bad ones. And the bad ones, they got to grab and throw them out. They've got a box alongside of them or a barrel. Now, can you imagine standing in a half-cold warehouse all day because they're cool? They call them cool rooms. You get them, they're not heated. Because if they heat them, it's hard on the merchandise. So the people that work there have to bundle up. And all day long, you're handling rotten potatoes, rotten onions. And if you get through with the potatoes, you get onions that are rotten, or carrots, or whatever. And they were paying them half of what they pay the men. That's what they had them for. Or they had them taking tomatoes, taking the bad tomatoes, throwing them out, and putting the good ones in tubes. And you see them in stores, and little, now they used to call them cellophane, now they're something else. Well, that's what they use women for in the marketing. The worst job. Then worst of all, they had women picking chickens. Are you familiar with that job? Mm-hmm. They bring in these chickens. They have a man usually. I've never seen a woman. And they stick the chicken with a pin someplace in the head. It kills them. Mm-hmm. Then they stick them on a conveyor belt. And that goes through some hot water. Oh, the stink and the smell of it. Upset your stomach. And then they got women that clean them chickens. They pick the feathers off. Mm. And it's a go, 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 go job all day long. And then after they get the feathers picked, they have to clean them. And that's a nastier job yet. They draw the insides on. Mm. And they got women doing this. In most cases, it's pretty near all women. And in all today, it's it's true today in these places that have frozen foods. They usually have ethnic women because they're cheaper than Yankee women, I mean English-speaking women. And they've got strikes that are going on right today. They've been going on for a year, year and a half, and we're continually putting money from our union and other unions to help them maintain their fights. Now, these were the things that we were trying to correct in Minneapolis. And we did, finally. We did it. And we set the stage for it. And I'm not worried about the time. I'm worried about that tape. And so that's the background of what happened in Minneapolis. Now, we succeeded in winning. And it revolutionized the Teamsters Union. It certainly did, and not without a struggle. I tell you, it's a tremendous subject, and we couldn't begin to cover it in 10 sessions like this, but it might be enough for you to do a paper on. I don't know.
What exactly were the specific goals when you went in on
what?
The strike? What were the specific goals?
Well, the goals, number one, were first was to recognize the union.
Now, was that a union, one solid union?
Yeah.
Okay, so it wasn't.
For all the people in the plant who wanted recognition, represent all the employees at a plant, at a trucking firm, by the union.
So that was to recognize one union instead of a bunch of separate?
Instead of a whole bunch of little unions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Interesting goals.
Next. We wanted seniority, that the men in their line of seniority would be maintained in service. And the senior man would be allowed to remain on the better jobs or that he had had. In other words, they couldn't get the boss's son, give him the gravy lick, and put the junior man and put the senior man doing the hard work. Then we wanted increased wages. But that come last. I mean, but then we wanted a work day, an 8-hour work day.
What was the original wage, and what was the wage? What was the original wage, and what were you?
What we were after then?
Yeah. What was the?
We were demanding 50 cents an hour, and the wage run from. They had many ways of paying you. They would pay you on commission. Mm-hmm. They would pay you depending on the company. They would pay you 25 cents. 30 cents, some cases 40 cents an hour, or they pay you by the day, or pay you by the week. What we wanted was an hourly rate of pay based on an 8-hour day, mm-hmm. time and a half for over.
How many hours had they been working prior to that?
Well, it used to be the idea that they gave you a lantern in the morning to find out where you left off the night before. When you'd leave the barn in the morning, mm-hmm. at 7 o'clock, you don't know what time you'd get in.